increasing, an increasing telephonic
group.
Leo.
Hi, how have you been?
You're good.
It refers to husband,
that was real.
He would be vaguely desired. Well, it was, the strange thing was when I started hearing all this, they had wanted to.
What exactly is the what do you mean when you say that?
I think we do have one.
Hi, Josh.
We talked about it. I think there's.
Correct.
I think there's one. I gotta check with Bob to make sure. If there's a private sector lease, still I think may have interest.
Oh, excuse me, Larry.
But I don't want to.
Karen.
Right.
Oh, Larry, hi.
Nice to meet you.
Well, you know, the issue.
How are you doing?
Oh, okay, we were gonna walk into the table since we have a lot of rooms boxes.
We have to have it sort of calling around.
But if you think you have a lean in that direction, then I'll approach you.
Let me check with John.
I have to get away from that.
So who's the answer?
I was worried that Mark's.
Yeah, I'm just being.
Let the chair. Thank you for arranging.
No, it's actually.
We have an option to buy from the state, so the SLTC has members.
But if we only have one.
Well, I'm thinking he might bring some energy.
Okay.
To the consumer, you know, he's quite a shit.
We didn't bring to.
And really, the insider makes it his career.
Actually, yeah.
Deputy Assistant Secretary, if you get the max here.
All right. Should we get started soon?
Yep.
We didn't bring any costs.
I suppose people maybe want to phone.
I had a question.
No, oh, there is no, okay.
Access.
So, yeah, that's what.
All right, for the folks on the phone, we're organizing ourselves and we will begin shortly.
Okay.
I was worried about you. I was sat here because of that. We got one of those.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, that's fine.
I'm very happy.
No, I'm just checking out. Are we good?
Charlie, you had a number. I'm sorry. Well, they didn't provide me.
Yeah, Laura.
It's complete.
Okay. Got it.
Do you know how long
this will
take? Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks.
The number of ones that people can be adjusted.
Okay.
Some of those names I put on.
Michael? We can get the door. All right, everyone. I want to thank everyone for coming bring this meeting to its open. My name is John Fitzpatrick. I'm the director of the Information Security Oversight Office and chair of this Policy Advisory Committee. This is the ninth overall meeting of this committee and first meeting of our 2015 meetings to be held. I remind everyone, this is a public meeting. It's also a bit of a virtual meeting. We have 15 or so people in the room, and I know we've got 10 or so folks joining us remotely, and we'll come around for introductions in just a few minutes. But this is a public meeting. It is recorded. Minutes for this meeting will be taken and posted through the ICE website and the other mechanisms that are designated federal official overseas. That's Associate Director Greg Pannoni. So we've got folks here in the room, and everyone here is mic'd up, and then we've got folks on the phone. We are, I'll say, in our second meeting of using this audio arrangement, which we hope will improve the ability for the folks on the phone to hear us and for us here in the room to hear you. So please speak up if you're having any issues, and if we ask you to speak up or repeat anything, please understand. Thanks very much. This meeting is open to the public, and as I said, the minutes will be taken and published. Also, we have the summary minutes from the last meeting that were made available to the people that are dialing in, as well as the folks that are here in the room. A couple of things that I'd like to do just from a membership standpoint. This body has reached its fourth birthday, and we've got some aspects of membership that are laid out by the reg and the directive that relate to terms. The term length being for 4 years. And we've got a number of folks that have been reps to the committee for those 4 years. On the government side, Elaine Cummins from FBI, Rick Homan from ODNI, Joe Lambert from CIA, who's here with us today, and Leo Masiano from State Department, who's also here with us today. And then Clyde Miller, who is our industry rep and our private sector rep and vice chair, and I'm assuming that Clyde's on the phone with us today.
That's here, Bob.
All right, there you are. So we first want to thank each and every one of you for your time and attention and endurance as we got this committee up and running, and for giving it your continued time and attention. We're very pleased. There's no term limit on the government employees, but there is a term expiration date on the state, local, tribal, and private sector reps, and we are very pleased that that Clyde has been renominated to start a second term, and he's agreed to do that. So thank you, Clyde, for that, for your commitment on those things. We have also a few changes in the works with other members. With regard to our Nuclear Regulatory Commission government members, Patricia Hollihan was one of the original members, has new duties at the NRC, and is no longer able to serve on the committee. I understand that we have Daryl Parsons on the line. Is Daryl?
Yes, sir.
Okay, terrific. And so Daryl's representing NRC in a virtual sense, and in a very real sense, but also virtually on the phone today. Dick Donovan was the Department of Energy rep for the startup of the committee, and he's been replaced by Mark Brooks, who I also expect is on the line. Mark, are you there?
That's correct, John. All right. Good morning.
Terrific. Thanks very much, and appreciate your commitment to the group. Chris Pickering was a Homeland Security Advisor Coordinator in the Missouri Department of Public Safety, and advised us in December he would no longer be able to serve on the committee. And we sent a request for nominations earlier this month, though it came from Bob Skorat and the ICU email. So please submit those by any nominations that you have to Bob by February 9th is the date we've asked for those. So with those sort of technical announcements out of the way, I'd like us to do introductions for the folks that are in the room. We'll go this way. I'm John Fitzpatrick, Director of ISU.
Greg Pannoni, Associate Director ISU and designated federal official for the meeting.
Leo Masiana, Senior Policy Advisor, Diplomatic Security, U.S. Department of State.
Joe Lambert, Director of Information Management for CIA.
Joseph Taylor, ISIN.
Bob Skura, ISIN.
Todd Coy, Atlanta Police Department.
John Mook, Harris County Sheriff's Office, Texas.
Lachlan McNeish, New Hanover County Sheriff's Office, Wilmington, North Carolina.
Charlie Rogers, I'm with the DHS Office of Security.
And also Vice Chair of the Committee.
Michael Manning, ISIN.
Cindy Richards, CIA.
Marvin Schofield, DHS.
All right.
Brian Meyer, DHS Office of Intergovernmental Affairs.
Terrific.
Terrific.
Thanks very much. And so that's who you've got in the room. We'd like folks to introduce themselves on the phone. Sometimes that's a bit of a collision. So I'm going to run down a list of who I expect might be on there and ask you all to say yay, verily, and hello. So Kevin Donovan. Jeff Friedland?
Yes, sir. Up here staying warm.
Great, Jeff. Lindsay Johnson?
I'm here.
All right. Welcome back, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Ben Linegang?
Present.
All right. Thanks, Ben. Dewey Webb?
I'm here. Thanks, Jeff.
Great. Thank you. Mark Brooks, Department of Energy?
Here, John.
And Glenn Bensley, Department of Justice?
Good morning.
All right. Other folks joining us, Lieutenant Greg Phillips.
Good morning, sir. I'm here.
Terrific. Julie Evans.
Good morning. Here for Will Palgren.
Terrific. From OPM, Trish Prasnikar and Carol Moorhart.
Yes, we're here. Hello, yeah.
Hello, OPM. Elizabeth Hanley, Department of State.
Hello.
Hi there. From DSS, Lisa Gearhart and Lovely Rodriguez.
Good morning. Yes, this is Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. All right, that's the end of my list. Are there any other folks on the phone?
Hi. Yes, John. Chris Forrest, representing Security Policy Oversight Division for Department of Defense.
Thanks very much, Chris. Welcome.
And again, Daryl Parsons from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Thank you, Daryl. Sorry, I announced you earlier, and I did the same for Clyde. So, Clyde Miller?
Clyde Miller, Director of Security for Southern California Edison, staying warm with a cold here in Los Angeles.
Is cold in Los Angeles?
With a cold.
With a cold. Oh, okay.
But it's probably a really good thing I'm not there.
Yeah, indeed. You'll get little sympathy from our New England and friends this week. They'd love to be in Los Angeles with a cold. All right, so with our introductions out of the way and a reminder that we've got an agenda and some guest briefers here that are going to walk us through that, but we also have an opportunity at the end of the meeting, if anything is not addressed that someone would like to raise, we'll have a window for that to happen. So I'd like to turn it over to Greg Pannoni, our designated federal official for review of old business.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few things. The minutes were certified on October 17th of 2014. Turning to fiscal matters, we continue to operate under budget limitations, which preclude reimbursement for travel and per diem, and we have the teleconference capability and will continue to do so. As far as the action items, there were three from the last meeting, and we will hear in this meeting updates on all three of them. The first concerns the briefing on the Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team. We hear about that and their role in information sharing and public safety. We'll also get an update on activities by the OPM and working with DHS on in updating the CVS, the Central Verification System, Clearance Verification System. For the stakeholders and constituency of this committee for improved access. And then both DHS and, as noted, Ms. Prasnikar and Ms. Moorhart from OPM will provide those updates. And then last is DHS. Mr. Rogers will also give us an update on initiatives to include members from the offices of the governor and the Homeland Security Advisor
on the liaison workshops that DHS conducts. And that's it. Anyone have any questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thanks. Any questions from folks online? All right.
None.
So I'd like to, I'll just say, make a few remarks off the top about recent announcements by the president, by the administration, that affect the community around state, local, tribal, and private sector information sharing. While this group was brought together with the primary focus of dealing with the sharing and protection of classified information that happens as a subset of that larger government to non-federal partner information sharing. So we have a focus on classified information sharing. There's a lot of attention and announcements in the last month or so, including the State of the Union, that puts emphasis on cybersecurity information sharing. And cybersecurity information sharing is inherently, its importance is understandable both if you're within the discipline of cybersecurity itself, or really cybersecurity issues that cross-cut any critical infrastructure protection priorities that the government might have. So I might have said in this meeting 6 months ago, cyber is everything and everything is cyber. At some point, there's a way to look at an issue and say either it's cyber primarily or cyber can touch it. And so I want to bring, I'll say just by reference, that thrust, those new efforts that the administration has been making and put it in the context of our own information sharing environment. I'm going to try to walk a tightrope here. The president is not done making announcements in this regard. It is not my place to get out in front of any announcements, and things that are in the works right now with regard to cyber information, cybersecurity information sharing. There are things in the works that are coming and should be announced soon. And I want to just say, highlight this fact for you. There's a cybersecurity summit planned for the middle of February. I think it's the president's going to gather the experts around cybersecurity on the 13th of February. And there's a lot of attention put into the continuing dialogue and continuing announcements that are going to come there. So it's important to recognize that while most of our agenda today is about things that we've been talking about and trying to do and incrementally getting started and continuing over the last 4 years, there's always new work, new emphasis, and I think this reflects very well on the focus and interagency cooperation that happens. There's a lot of cybersecurity expertise and responsibility in the Department of Homeland Security, and they have, of course, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Program mission on top of that. And so we can see the reason that leadership continues to come from there. The cybersecurity partners for other federal programs are represented in this room, FBI, Department of Justice, Intelligence Community. And so there's the thread of all of our partners here that are involved in that. And so I would focus your attention on the dialogue around cybersecurity. Look for future announcements on that, and I would expect that those kinds of things will be discussed in our meetings going forward, and you'll see an increase in the thrust around cybersecurity information sharing in the context of our classified information sharing program. So without having announced anything that hasn't been announced, I'm going to stop right there. And now I'm going to turn it over to Charlie Rogers to take us through some of the security program implementation updates. Charlie?
Yeah.
I guess I'll stand at the podium.
Yep, please.
All right.
And I had to look at my notes.
There's a number of areas that I'm going to cover, mostly updates on existing programs. So because there's new members and because I really need to put these things in context, bear with me because I'm going to describe briefly what the program is so I can tell you what the metric means. And the first thing I was going to talk about is an update on the Security Compliance Review Program in DHS, and that's a program that's established under the implementing directive for the EO, and it requires that we, on a periodic basis, go out to state and local facilities that have classified information, with the primary targets being fusion centers because they have a Homeland Security data network, a secret level network. So we have a big interest in visiting them. And the primary purpose of the Security Compliance Review Program is similar to other government security compliance review programs in that we're looking at how well they're safeguarding classified, whether they're applying policies consistently, whether they are receiving the training they need, and that they're managing their secure facilities and classified. So just to give you an update on the metrics associated with that, the program started in late 2012, in September 2012. And since then, to date, we've done 43 security compliance reviews. And that's a pretty significant number. There are 53 primary fusion centers with another 25 recognized fusion centers, but the 53 primary fusion centers. So we're almost done with all the primary fusion centers. So last year we did 19 security compliance reviews. Thus far this year, or this fiscal year, 15, we've done two. We got four more scheduled. So we're moving forward with that program. And we're not done with fusion centers. I just had a person on our staff fly out to Guam, which was quite a trip, and did a final certification review on a room at their fusion center. So in the near term, Guam will be another fusion center that will receive HSDN and be connected into this this system. And the other territories of Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands is being worked right now too. And there's always challenges. They were the last ones because obviously they're not part of the continental United States, and there are challenges in alarming rooms at remote locations, if you can imagine. Anyway, that's the update on the Security Compliance Review Program. The other topic that I was to talk to about is security liaison training. And once again, to put that into context, the implementing directive for the executive order requires that facilities, locations, state and local tribal locations that are storing classified information are obligated to appoint a security liaison. And that person is essentially a security officer for the state and local facility. And they have a number of responsibilities that we expect them to carry out and work with us on. So security liaison training becomes an important aspect of keeping the expertise in those locations. And it's a challenge because the liaisons do turn over frequently. Some of them are only there for a year. We're fortunate that some are multi-year seems to be career positions, but a lot of them are other duties as assigned, and so we're always trying to retrain them. So I'll give you a little update on how we're trying to meet that challenge. The implementing directive requires that when a security liaison is appointed, that they be trained in 60 days. And we do have a very thorough training that takes place through a national conference, but that's usually once every 18 to 24 months. So the challenge is how do we train security liaison in the interim? And we started webinars more or less monthly. They're not always monthly, but we've started webinars with newly appointed security liaisons in 2013. We did eight webinars. Of course, sometimes we only have one or two liaisons, but the idea is to give them an overview of what their responsibilities are, to put them in touch with the appropriate personnel, to get them the documents they need and to start a conversation about their roles and responsibility. In 2014, we trained
27 security liaison through these webinars. Today, in FY 2015, we've had three of the webinars and trained nine security liaison. And although the numbers are low, that still represents a significant piece of the fusion centers. But the webinars are not really the most effective way to train. So we have a partnership with the Intelligence and Analysis Directorate in DHS, who has an interest in the Fusion Center since they are the primary information sharing partners with the Fusion Center. And they fund quarterly training events, two-day events here in DC, in which newly appointed liaisons are brought into DC and they get 2 days of full-fledged training by my staff and the INA staff. And as a matter of fact, there's one taking place today. We've got 10 liaisons today at headquarters. They'll be trained today and tomorrow. And, you know, it goes over, I won't go into all the details, but it goes over how to manage a secure room, how to manage the IDSs, the security clearance process, CompSec, the kind of policies that directly affect them, self-inspections, how to conduct a self-inspection, and those kind of things, which, so that's the other way we're reaching the security liaisons. The other way, and I won't go into this right now, but the other way is that INA also funds a national event which brings about 75 to 80 liaisons into a single location for 3 days worth of training. And we're involved in that. INA has the money to make it happen, which is a great thing. And they're also involved. But those events usually take place about every 18 to 24 months. It takes a while to get the money and the wherewithal to make it happen. And this kind of segues into my next topic, which has to do with the governors and the HSA staff getting trained. We have challenges. There is a Homeland Security Advisor, and the state governors have a certain amount of classified at their location, not very much, but they do store classified, at least most of them do. They're integrally involved in the security clearance nominating process for personnel in their states. We look at them to validate the nominations that come forward to DHS from the fusion centers. And they usually have a classified CompSec at the governor's, available to the governor. So we've been working to figure out how to get them trained. And the decision has been made that the security liaisons will be brought in to the next security liaison conference. We're going to be working with Intergovernmental Affairs to communicate with them more directly. We maintain a roster of the security point of contacts in the HSA's office, and that's being updated. It's always being updated. But since the elections, we've got to get the new staff. But the idea is to initially bring the new staff into the HSIN community of interest that deals with security, and then to begin to get them integrated into the coordination process, identifying training blocks and that kind of things for the next conference with INA. We haven't even started those discussions on the conference yet, so there's not a lot to come back other than there's a commitment to do it. And then I'll talk about just a couple of little things we've done. One was the security liaison transition checklist, and I think this originally came up by a member. It may have been Clyde Miller, but one of the members of the PAC suggested that do we have a kind of a mechanism in place to help security liaisons transition duties since there is a large turnover of them. So INA helped draft what they thought was the kind of content that should be into a transition plan. Office of Security got engaged. We added the things that we thought were important. It was staffed out to a select number of security liaisons for them, their input. And we now do have a security liaison transition checklist. And I think it's a helpful thing. It was nice that it was suggested. It's not a long document, but it's 4 or 5 pages. It has like 10 sections with, of course, subsections. Half of the document is focused on the outgoing security liaison and directs him the kind of things that he or she need to do. as they are leaving, the kind of documents they need to collect, the materials they need to glean, and the overview they have to give. And it's in the form of a checklist for them. And then another part of the checklist is for the incoming security liaison, which advises him or her that who to contact, that you need to get a CVS account, you need to get a HISN account, you need to identify the passwords for the alarm company, you need to get to collect the number of security containers and change the combinations and those kind of things. So that's been implemented. It's been distributed to the existing security liaisons. It's been posted to the HISN site. I can certainly share it with you all. I don't have a copy with me today, but I can share it for those who are interested, or give it to ISU and they can distribute it. Yep. The other thing we implemented to improve the security compliance review program is we go out and we coordinate with the fusion centers, we contact them, we tell them we're coming, we tell them they need to be available, we tell them the kind of data they need to give to us, and then we send people out and we, I don't want to say interfere, but we can be interfering with their existing operations. We interview people there, we review their holdings, we review how they manage the room, their training records. But they don't really get an opportunity to criticize us or to tell us how we're doing. So we've decided that Fusion Center directors are very busy. They get contacted by lots of people. So we're going to keep it simple, but we've developed an after-action survey, about 7 questions, that'll go to the Fusion Center director. He can share it with the security liaison and anyone else who was engaged in the security compliance review. And it basically asks him to tell us how we're doing. How are, are the folks knowledgeable? Are they professional? Are they communicating clearly? Are they, acting in a manner which we would expect? And that way we can then make adjustments and improvements to the way we do business. So it was the coordination effective. Did you have enough time to do what you needed to do? The security compliance reviews aren't going to go away, but we want to be able to make them as positive and as professional as possible. And there's also a small section in the survey for them to tell us if we're doing things right. So we're not just soliciting, tell us how bad we are. That's another thing that's changed that I just wanted to give an update on. The last thing is I just wanted to talk briefly about personnel security. A lot of people ask me questions about it, and I'm not going to give you the exact numbers, but since DHS has stood up in 2003, we've cleared just under 5,000 state, local, and tribal personnel. And we have cleared an additional just under 2,000 private sector people. So we have, 6,500 to under 2,000 people that we've cleared to support DHS missions and the information sharing and, the protection of critical infrastructure, the fusion centers, they all fall into that number. By far, the vast majority of these clearances are at the secret level. Those locations where we deploy HSDN is at the secret level. We have just over 400 of them, however, who do either have a TS clearance or have a TSSCI clearance. And those folks are exceptions to the policy. They have a mission requirement to either sit on a board, to be detailed to a DHS SCIF, or to be engaged in a federal mission activity that needs their input in that level of classified. We are seeing, as you can see, the breakdown is 5,000 state, local, tribal, less than 2,000 private sector. And of course there's a turnover and there's people who leave, but we are seeing that there is an increase in the private sector, and primarily because there's an increase in mission activity, and I think the cyber is part of that, identifying subject matter experts that can work with DHS. So we're seeing a slight uptick in the number of private sector clearances that are being sponsored. And I'll add one little other thing, and that is with these numbers, it's a challenge for us to train these folks effectively. I mean, there's different ways you can train people. you can send them a briefing as an email attachment. And I've spoken in the past, we have a HISN site, a Homeland Security Information Network site. The security liaisons use it. We eventually want to get the Homeland Security Advisors security staff to use it. But we found that it's too much of a challenge to get 7,000 people to get an account to a single account that they're going to use once every year to receive training. So we are looking at, there are ways that we found out through speaking to our security liaisons who use HISN and others, there are ways you can do one-time sign-on. So we're working through the challenge of figuring out how to use that as a platform for training where we invite people for a one-time sign-on, yet still are able to track that they did the training. So we have a new employee in the Office of Security, Mervin Schofield, Schofield, who's here today, and he's a systems analyst, and he's going to help us see if we can't connect the dots on how to eventually get a more effective training protocol. So, and that pretty much concludes the points I wanted to make.
That's terrific. Are there any questions for Charlie? For folks on the phone? I do want to say, since I started out talking about this is the ninth meeting and we've been at this now for 4.5 years, it is remarkable how we've gone from, I'll say, the DHS rep talking about all the things that needed to get started and stood up so that we could have this program, and now where we are, I'll say, in refinements, in additions, in you know, sort of new features, the notion of the new attempts at finding the best path to train such a broad number of people. I do think that, you know, you ought to take a moment and appreciate that we've gone from a not so distant, in the not so distant path, we've come a great way, and I think also give credit to everybody involved doing that. I think, I don't know if you want to stay there or you want to come on back here, but I think our next step is to talk about changes to the central verification system, OPM's clearance system, and Trish and Carol are on the line to do that with you, Charlie.
Yeah, and I think the plan is for me to present kind of a broad overview, and I'm not a technical person, and then Carol and Tricia could jump in or answer questions if there are questions, but I'll try and give an overview. Early on when the executive order was signed, there was a requirement to try and figure out how we can get state and locals the ability to verify clearances in order to facilitate their classified operations. And for us in the federal government, you know, passing clearances and all that may be a hindrance or a slight inconvenience, but for state and local, it is quite a burden, because if you're in a fusion center and you're working with 6 or 7 different federal agencies and you're going to have a classified meeting and these people are coming to the meeting tomorrow and they're telling you that they have security clearances, then you need to call 6 or 7 federal agencies to verify their clearances and do it in a day and find the right person in a security office and get the clearance passed. So the decision was made, and OPM, gratefully identified the clearance verification system as the best mechanism and vehicle that could be used as a central repository for state and locals to get accounts and to be able to access and verify clearances to conduct their business. And a number of the security liaisons were given CVS accounts, but that was an interim solution. And so what OPM has done over the last couple of years is they've been, and I don't know if I have the right words, but they've been going through a systems transformation or a reconfiguration of the CVS system, and they worked with us and other federal agencies to identify the kind of structure that this, what they call the security liaison user role, should have. And it is now ready to be operated. It's ready for deployment. What it does is it enables, or will enable, once we transfer the existing CVS state and local users to it, it will enable them to verify clearances up to the secret level, which is what their operating level is in the fusion centers. Through the central verification system, it connects to what they call the suitability investigation index, and it also has a connection to DOD's Joint Personnel Adjudication System, or JPASS. So We are on the verge of doing it. There were some technical glitches, but OPM recently created a user guide and created a webinar. We have users right now using the existing CVS. We need to have some meetings internally in DHS and then connect with OPM, and we will begin to transition the existing CVS users into the new security liaison user role. They can take the webinar, have access to the user guide, and that should happen within a few weeks. At least the process should happen. And then once that happens and it's successful, then we'll begin to nominate new security liaisons that don't have existing accounts. But the focus will be initially to transfer the existing users into the security user role and then to nominate new people who need access down the road. So Tricia and Carol, I think I covered as best I can where we're at, and if you all want to jump in and add anything.
I think that was excellent, Charlie. We're standing by, ready to help with the transition of the users, and I'm sure we'll be meeting with you soon.
And I guess if there's any questions of them that I can't answer, they're on the phone.
This is Chris Forrest with Department of Defense. Is there any cost estimate associated with this effort?
Well, for DHS, gratefully, no. I think it did cost OPM money to reconfigure the system.
That would be correct, Charlie. Naturally there were some costs incurred whenever we had, come up with a new user role and create some additional new screens and take into consideration JPASS and the SII and CBS that you referenced earlier in order to come up with a response to say whether the person of their query is at a active secret level or not.
The fortunate thing, I think, is that this request occurred when CVS was going through a an improvement already. Is that correct? You were already working to transform the system, and so it was fortunate that we were able to get into that process.
That's right. Yeah, our developers worked closely with the models we had already been developing for the transformation and upgrades of our system. So I don't know if the questions are more on like a per capita user basis or if it's just about the overall budget for the project, but we'd have to take that back at OPM if you need further clarification.
And that's fine. And Tricia, I'll contact you offline and we can discuss that.
Okay.
Great. Any other questions from folks about CVS?
This is Clyde. I'd just like to make the comment that much like the progress that you made on the other items that you briefed us on, going from the first meeting I remember where this was discussed, and it seemed like dealing with all of the nuances of trying to deal with multiple government agencies, ever getting this done was going to be a head scratcher, and the fact that it's ready to deploy is something that I think we need to congratulate you as well as the folks over OPM on. This has been, a significant effort, and it's great progress in making it so much easier to be able to put the measures in place to be able to share information across the sectors and with the state and local tribal folks. So it's kudos to you guys.
Well said.
To be absolutely clear, OPM held our hands and did the great amount of work on this. They listened to us, they educated us, and they created the solution. So really it goes to OPM and those folks at JPASS who work with them.
Terrific.
Thank you very much.
All right. And thanks, Trish and Carol. Appreciate it. Okay, so what we'd like to do now is turn to the next item on our agenda, and I'm going to ask Lori Lothan of the FBI to kick us off here. We're going to shift from talking about process and background kind of stuff to the actual business of information sharing and the context in which it happens. Lori is here on behalf of FBI member Elaine Cummins, so thank you for coming, and please give our best to Elaine, and take it away. And there's a briefing that we're going to go through here that I believe was provided to the folks on the phone earlier today by Bob Scarrott. So, Check that email attachment if you don't have it up in front.
Okay, so we're going to hear a briefing from the Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team, which is housed over at the National Counterterrorism Center in the Tyson McLean area. We have with us as the Bay News and Force folks from those. Thank you. That have come in on one-year fellowships. Todd is an FBI fellow. John and Mac are both DHS fellows. They have TSSCI clearances, and they are working hand-in-hand with the partners, NCTC, DHS, and us, as well as the rest of the IC, to further produce products and advance the information sharing for our first responders. So I'm going to let them do the presentation, as that's why they're here. Thank you.
Thanks very much. You take the podium if you will.
Good morning. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of the committee this morning and folks that are here virtually. Again, my name is Lachlan McNeish. I am a captain with the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office. Detailed, I am a DHS body. So for the DHS folks, thank you. You'll see that this is a briefing that will encompass what the ODNI, DHS, FBI, and the folks over at NCTC are trying to do as a whole for information sharing, not only at the federal level, but getting it all the way down from to the state, local, tribal, and territorial first responders in the field that can actually use information day in and day out, and specifically trends, tactics, and procedures. And John will touch on some of that here in a few minutes as I roll through this. Next slide, please. As you can see, I'm not going to read that verbatim. The mission statement is there in front of you. This is a joint unit at NCTC, which Dr. Latham talked about, FBI, DHS, and we coordinate throughout the center and amongst the IC for information collaboration. And that is our foundation. Information collaboration and sharing. Taking information and taking from the highest level and trying to get it down to the nuts and bolts to the first responders in the field that can actually use this information for our primary function as a whole, protecting the homeland. Next slide, please. Again, JCAT was, it's now in its, if you excuse the expression, its second phase. It was established in 2013 from a parent group or unit at NCTC prior to, which was the ITAC-G, the Interagency Assessment and Coordination Group. ITAC-G was initially run with the director being a DHS body, and it's now transitioned to NCTC, where you have an NCTC director of the unit, then, for example, Lori, who is the deputy director, who's an FBI body, and our other deputy is a DHS body. So that helps coordinate and, excuse the expression, grease the skids when we're doing project development coordination within the IC and within the center itself. There were some funding changes back in 2013, where we actually transferred from the original ITAC-G to now the JCAT. Next slide, please, sir. Again, the unit between the ITAC-G and now JCAT was came out from the 9/11 Commission report. There were key members in Congress that saw that there was a lack of information sharing that was taking place between state and local, tribal and territorial entities in the field. And this was the bridge to kind of fix the information sharing gap, if you'll give me a little bit of leeway with that expression, where information can, with folks that have clearances, can coordinate, help develop, and establish products from Intel at a high level, break it down to its basic fundamental need of trends, tactics, and procedures that will help inform our first responders in the field across the country. And in retrospect, a lot of folks don't understand that every day there's 800,000 law enforcement officers in the homeland. There's another 1.2 million firefighters in the homeland, not including our health and human services folks that are government employees, our paramedics, and our healthcare workers. That's a lot of eyes in the field. So when we take this information and process it and get it down to us, the foundation where we can use it every day, it's a huge asset for us. Next slide, please, sir. At this point, John is going to come up. He's going to talk about some of the understanding between state and locals.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm John Mook. I'm with the Harris County Sheriff's Office in Texas.
prior to that, I was with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, FBI Houston. Here we are, almost 14 years past 9/11, and we're discussing information sharing. Well, you know, up until a couple years ago, I had no clue what the National Counterterrorism Center was or what the Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team was. My sheriff fortunately did and thought that I would be a good fit, so here I am. Some of the things we do, and as Mac mentioned, there are 800,000 approximate law enforcement agents out there. There's 1.2 million firefighters, EMS personnel out there. We are considered pickets out there. Well, we should be considered pickets out there because we're out there running into things that should be recognizable to combat terrorism. The question is, how do we get it to these folks? And this is what JCAT does. We will look at events from around the world. And again, it's not important for the individual officer or fireman out there to know who's involved. What we're mainly concerned about is techniques, tactics, and procedures. You know, what we, in the news today, or this week, you know, drone ends up landing on the White House lawn. Okay, are terrorists overseas looking at using that and leveraging those things to commit attacks here in the homeland? Okay, that's something we'll take a look at and perhaps write a product on and push it down. There are many ways of getting this information out. We have the HISN network. We also have the Law Enforcement Enterprise Portal, which used to be LEO. And we also have other online processes which people can sign up for. Some of the other things we do up here with the intelligence community is we will look at things that they put out. We will go through them and see if there's anything that applies to law enforcement or fire services or EMS. For instance, a local case you had not too long ago was some kid was building bombs in his house. He ends up burning himself. And when the firefighters respond with the EMS personnel, this guy says he's welding, and that's what his injuries are caused by. Well, obviously it wasn't. He ends up going to the hospital. Police get called. And basically, he's got a bomb factory in his house. And of course, that's not the first time we've seen this here in the United States. Is he doing it for terrorist reasons, or is it for something else? Something that, again, we'll look at, we'll analyze it, and a product will be put out. Partner liaison and outreach. Again, here we are past 9/11 for over a decade now. How many people out there actually know that there's a National Counterterrorism Center or a Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team? So what we'll do is we'll go out, and what I've done in my 9 months up here is gone to conventions for both fire chiefs and police officers, and we will let those agencies know we are available, this is what we do, this is how you can get our information, and hopefully they will take that. You know, I come from a 4,300 or so member agency, which is fairly huge, but you have to keep in mind the majority of police departments around the United States are less than 10 folks. So do they have these budgets to do training? No, they don't. But if they have a computer, they can access our products free of charge and use those to do their jobs with. IC education, something else that we've done or that we continue to do up here, is that we will meet with members of the intelligence community and give them an idea of what we as first responders are looking for in products. We will help them craft their products because, again, we don't need to know who or the particulars of any case except for techniques, tactics, and procedures. So we will assist in getting those written and engaging those folks that write these products to get them down to an unclassified level because your first responders generally will not have secret or even top secret clearances. And what we try and stress to them is that, yeah, it's nice to write that product that the president or some policymakers are going to read and perhaps use, but you can leverage nearly 2 million folks out there in the field to take your product and, you know, hopefully protect or actually disrupt plots in the homeland. Next slide, please. Some of the products that we will produce are roll call releases and fireline products. As you can see, if you have those in front of you. And these are just examples of some of the things that we do. Again, they are unclassified for official use only, so that they are available to the first responders out there. Next slide. And those are the examples of fire lines. Next slide. And again, these are the portals that first responders have the availability to get a hold of. LEO is now the LEAP, Law Enforcement Enterprise Portal. Homeland Security has their HISN, and the risk can be gained through LEAP. Next slide. Something else that we're currently working on is revising the intelligence guide for first responders. Again, this will be an FOUO unclassified product available to first responders. ITAG-G, again, is now JCAT. Next slide. And this is what we try and harp on, again, you know, written by state, local, tribal, and federal partners, indications and warnings, and terrorist tactics, techniques, and procedures. This is the meat of what we do. This is what the first responders out there should and can get a hold of to protect the homeland. Next slide. And JCAT, we have members from local law enforcement agencies. We have federal intelligence analysts. We all have top secret SCI clearances. We are here for 1 year to get an idea of what goes on at the federal level to assist those at the federal level writing products to get products out to first responders. And of course, this benefits us is when we go back to our home agencies and back to our territories, that we can be ambassadors for the counterintelligence, counterterrorism community, and hopefully get other people involved and access to these products. Do you have any questions?
Are you the first detailees through the cycle?
No, sir. This ITAG-G was stood up back in.
That's right.
So we, you know, there are 9 positions available, and we do have 4 of them that are filled. We would like to see more participation, absolutely.
Always. Good.
I was just going to add this for those on the phone, this is Lori over at FBI. Some of the products that we do have an impact to the private sector, and we have shared those as well. Some private sector members have access through HISN. We also send them out through InfraGuard, their portal, and the DSEC portals. So just so those in the private sector understand that we are also looking out for that, again, first responders. And as John alluded to, from FBI and DHS and NCTC's perspective, especially I think FBI because we have such a large footprint out in the field, we are trying to get the fellowship program a little bit more breadth, so that they see more and experience more, because we really feel selfishly for the FBI when they go back out that they're really our touchstone, and they can help educate more people when they get out there. So we really encourage anybody who's on the phone, I apologize for squeaking, if you know of anybody who may be interested, we have 3 different fellowship programs, NCTC's, DHS's, and FBI's are all a little bit different. You can certainly contact me and I can walk you through any of that, whether it's about the fellowship program or how to get access to our products. I can't say enough about the people that come in and give up a year of their lives to do this. It's truly been a blessing for my career to work with these guys. So thank you.
Are there any comments or questions from folks here in the room or on the phone?
I have a just sort of an involvement question with all of this. Appreciate all the efforts, the idea of all those that are involved, the first responders, and the numbers coming up to around 2 million. And I have no idea what the yield might be, but it occurred to me, maybe it's already been thought of, the United States Postal Service every day, maybe from a little bit indirect perspective, interacts at least with the places of residences of everyone. Is there any coordination, tie-in, connection with the USPS in terms of, heightened awareness as they do have daily interaction, at least for now, unless the Postal Service goes away, which it could very well one day?
If I may, sir, it's my understanding. Downstairs at NCTC, we got the national JTTTF, the National Joint Terrorism Task Force, and it's my understanding we do have the U.S. Postal Inspector's Office as part of that task force downstairs in our building, so they more than have access to the same resource that John has discussed and that Lori's talked about, and they're part of that organization just pretty much every 1811 federal organization within the federal government. The one thing unique to that is they also bring together the state and locals from around the major metropolitan areas from the country and embed them with their local JTTF office that are DHL similar to us in that same office. And we coordinate with them daily on some issues. Like John indicated earlier, he came from the JTTF. I'm JTTF and I'll be going back as a collateral duty as well as a commander. And Todd's background with Homeland Security in Atlanta. So, just pretty much at this table right here, you've got over 65 years of law enforcement experience, not to include the folks that have already come through the door between ITAC-G and JCAT, mm-hmm. If that answers your question. Yes,
well, in addition to that, if I may, also something Homeland Security pushes is the suspicious activity reporting program. So there are ways of anybody, but particularly federal employees, and to push that information up to those that need it.
Thank you.
Hey, and this is Lindsay at the Tennessee Fusion Center. Kind of speaking from the Fusion Center standpoint, I know we do and other Fusion Centers probably do have frequent contact with our postal workers, and they're, included on our distribution list, and we work with them hand-in-hand on cases or whatnot. So we have that connection from the education standpoint, the dissemination of information and kind of working together as well at the state and local level.
That's good to hear.
Thank you, Lindsay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
John, Papa, thank you. All right, so we're here to the open forum portion of our program. I normally would turn to one side and say to Clyde, as vice chair, anything you'd like to share with the groups. I will do that virtually, Clyde.
Well, thank you. First of all, I think from my perspective, this is my first time for calling in virtually, and I sincerely apologize for not being there in person, but I think the sound system worked well. I could hear just about everybody, especially the speakers that were presenting, and I appreciate the presentation on the Joint Counterterrorism Assessment Team. That's to be frank with you, I think that's an organization I wasn't aware that existed out there. So it's good to see that's an initiative that's being undertaken. And second of all, just to reiterate, it's in reflecting on where we started 4 years ago, it's refreshing to see how much progress we have made. And as Charlie knows, because I've been in contact with him on some issues one-off circumstance. Still got a little work to do, but we've made a lot of progress there, and that's good. And thank you for being so politically astute in your comments about the administration's information sharing initiatives. I think it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out.
It is a big watch this space kind of a tip-off, so yes. All right, thanks very much, Clyde. Anyone else on the phone like to jump in, raise an issue or a comment? All right, and the folks in the room? Well, thank everybody for skipping right past you.
I was just wondering on the JCAT, what tribal involvement has there been?
Just recently, I went to the National Association of Law Enforcement Agents in Las Vegas, and we set up a program or our booth out there and did outreach to those members. I do believe we've had at least one fellow that's been up here already.
Correct. My apologies. Any other questions or comments from folks in the room? All right, so we'll bring this one to a close with word that our next public meeting will be in the summer on July 22nd, right here. And we will have updates. And if anyone has a suggestion or request for material that they would like to see addressed, if you have a presentation that you think would be helpful for this group, that you've seen perhaps in another forum and you think it would be great, please make that suggestion. ISU, address your suggestions to Bob Skorat, and we will see everyone in July. Thanks very much. And thanks to Julie, whose fingers are on the knobs and beating back the feedback and making us all audible to each other. So thank you, Julie. All right, and we will conclude right now. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.